Finance Minister Grant Robertson with us on the tightrope of addressing the burgeoning cost of living without fuelling inflation while keeping the economy going. The centrepiece of yesterday's budget was a $1 billion cost of living package, including a $350 payment over 3 months to low and middle income earners who don't qualify for the winter energy payment, in other words, not beneficiaries. There's also a two-month extension of half-price public transport and fuel excise and road user charge reductions. The funding for the package won't come from the government's $6 billion in new operating spending, but from reprioritising funding from the closure of the COVID-19 Response and Recovery Fund. There is a big spend-up in health in this budget. Inflation is currently at a 30-year high at 6.9%. Treasury's latest forecast released yesterday sees annual inflation fall to 5.2% over 2023, to 2.2% by mid-2026. It takes till then to get back to the mid-range of the Reserve Bank's target for inflation. But there are many uncertainties. War in Ukraine, the continuing impacts of the pandemic, global supply chain disruption, and the direction of the global economy. Has the Finance Minister got the mix right? Kia ora, Grant Robertson, and thank you for your time.
Thanks, Catherine.
$350 a household for many, in fact for millions, under 70k but not beneficiaries, that's the setting. Some feedback already though, it's something, but as one person said, it's like giving someone $20 and we've solved all your problems. It's a drop in the bucket, Minister, against the cost of living onslaught.
Well, we've never claimed that it was anything more than a contribution to support a wider group of New Zealanders. We obviously made significant increases on the 1st of April to main income support benefits, student allowances, superannuation. We then have the winter energy payment kicking in on the 1st of May. But it's clear the cost of living pressures driven by all of those forces you've just mentioned, from the war in Ukraine to the supply chain constraints that come off the back of COVID, are having an impact on a wider group of New Zealanders. And we wanted to make a contribution to that at the period at which inflation is seen to be at its peak. It is, as you've said, a bit of a tightrope here. We live in very uncertain and volatile times economically, globally, that's impacting on households here in New Zealand. So we've had to get a balance in this budget. It's a careful balance where we try not to fuel that inflation, but protect New Zealanders against the worst of it. And I'm confident we've got a good balance here that takes us forward on to be able to address those bigger issues as well.
Just enough for a ticket to Aussie, the opposition says, and it's a catchy line. How serious?
Well,
go ahead.
I don't know if it is, to be honest with you, Catherine, because what this gives is $27 a week to those people for that three-month period, which is a lot more than the what they would have got from National's tax cuts, which are untargeted, unfocused, and will actually fuel inflation. And so it's a contribution alongside many other things that we're doing to be able to help support New Zealanders through this period of time.
How serious do you expect the outflow of New Zealanders to be over the rest of this year and 2023? Have you taken advice on that?
Yeah, well, the budget itself has what the migration forecasts that the Treasury are making, and that says that by the end of 2023, we'll be back to net positive 20,000 migration, and then that grows to 40,000 by the end of 2025, 26. So we are going to be seeing net positive migration. I don't think there's any doubt that there's a bit of pent-up demand for New Zealanders who want to leave and go off and do their OE. We all know that the OE is part of a big part of New Zealanders' experience. But equally, we've got plenty of people who want to come and live in New Zealand as well.
Given the critical skills shortages in everything from nursing to the trades, why wasn't a real move to try and retain some of these people a feature of your budget yesterday?
Well, I mean, I think the overall approach we've taken over the last few years is to support New Zealanders and support households through COVID and to continue to help create good jobs in the economy. And there's every reason for people to stay in New Zealand. Unemployment is at a record low. Our standard of living remains high compared to the rest of the world. We are training more and more New Zealanders, giving them skills through free apprenticeships and targeted trade training. So there's a lot of reasons to do that. We know, though, that historically for New Zealand, we do fill our skill gaps with immigration, and we announced the immigration rebalance. There's a series of measures in there to make it easier for people to come in those very occupations that you mentioned, and the creation of the green list, which means that there's a pathway to residency for people on that list. So I think the balance is there of supporting New Zealanders, training up more New Zealanders, but also using the immigration system to fill those skill gaps.
We know of one case of a nurse graduate from Wellington who recently applied for 3 nursing jobs in Melbourne, got all of them, chose the one she wanted, and is now earning 75,000 Australian, which is about what a senior nurse earns here in New Zealand. That's what you're up against, Minister.
And look, the wage gap between New Zealand and Australia is a many decades long thing. When it comes to the nursing workforce, we've increased wages by more than 20% since our time in office for the nursing workforce. We have a pay equity deal ready to go once we can get that over the line that will increase wages even more for nurses here. So we are focused on making sure that we train more people. We've had 3,000 extra nurses come on board, or places for 3,000 extra nurses come on board in our health system over the last few years. Wages are lifting, and historically that gap's been there, but there continues to be a focus from the government on making sure we do pay nurses what they're worth.
There's the $350 handout then to mid-income and below households, as long as they're not on a benefit. Why not lock in some more long-term cost of living assistance that is unlikely to be inflationary, especially, say, in public transport? Doesn't it make sense to make that half-price public transport permanent? You're doing it for community service card holders. Why not for everyone, for working commuters? Doesn't that hit two targets?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a targeted response. And as you're noting, we've extended out for 2 more months that for everybody. We're then moving to doing it for community services card holders. There are other investments in public transport in the budget as well. We're funding the decarbonising of our public transport fleet. We're funding paying bus drivers properly so that we've actually got the drivers to make sure we can fulfil the demand that there is for this. And I would expect in future budgets, and as we meet our climate change goals, there will be even more investment both in the infrastructure of public transport and making it more accessible and affordable. In this particular budget, at this time, with such a volatile environment and the need to get that balance right, we think the targeted extension of that public transport subsidy and the halving of prices is the right approach. But there will definitely be more in future budgets around public transport.
Okay, it's all a bit bitsy, whether it's the cash or the public transport subsidies. It's the band-aid is the term that's been used. And whether or not you accept or reject that, what are your answers to the relentless onslaught on household budgets? Mortgage interest rate increases, sky-high rents, soaring food and energy prices. What is the answer now to the number one issue that households are facing?
Like most things in life, there's not going to be one single silver bullet for this. What we have consistently seen up until this year is wages outstripping inflation. In the budget forecast put out yesterday, wages start outstripping inflation again from next year. We have this very particular issue in 2022. It's the reason why we took 25 cents litre off the fuel excise duty. It's the reason why we halved public transport costs. It's the reason why we lifted family tax credits on the 1st of April. We've got the winter energy payment. We now have this payment. The government is stepping into support. Ultimately, we want more people in work earning more money. That's what the rest of the budget's about, to support the creation of those jobs. We have very low unemployment in New Zealand at the moment. People are in work. We've got through COVID well. We get through this next bit of the cost of living crisis well, and we come out the other side with a more productive economy. That is the plan.
I want to come back to that, but Treasury has inflation still at more than 5% next year. Is that going to be tolerable for many households? It doesn't drop back to 2%, the Reserve Bank target range, mid of the target range, till 2026. That's 4 years away. Is this going to be tolerable?
It is a very difficult period in the global economy for inflation. Just 2 nights ago, the UK announced 9% inflation for April. We've had the US up over 8%, Germany up over 7%, the average for the OECD over 8%. This is a global phenomenon. New Zealand does see a track in these forecasts for inflation coming down, but we are not immune to what is happening with a Russian invasion of Ukraine that's pushing oil prices up, or with the COVID-related supply chain constraints. So yes, this is going to be a difficult period. We are supporting New Zealanders through that
period. Let's take it as a given, but this isn't just a 1 or 2 year pandemic hangover now, not even with house prices easing off a fraction. These rent and food and energy costs are locked in. They might plateau at some point as inflation eases, but they're locked in. And is this tolerable for households going forward?
It's obviously a tough period for households, and that's the reason why we've stepped in with what we have. But I just reiterate, we've had wages ahead of inflation up until this year, and the forecasts tell us that wages will run ahead of inflation for all the years past this one. So we do have a situation in 2022 that is particularly tough, and we're stepping forward with support on that. We have an economy, Catherine, that is actually going very well compared to the rest of the world. That's been recognised by the IMF and the OECD and by the ratings agencies. We are well positioned to support New Zealanders through these challenges, but we cannot take ourselves out of the world and the impact that the global economy has on households.
Well, can we look at our own economy a little bit more closely for a moment then? Many forecasters are now predicting it's heading for at least a technical recession, short and sharp, hopefully. Are you expecting that, by the way?
Well, that isn't what the forecast says.
It's what the forecasters are saying, and Treasury's record on accuracy with forecasting has been volatile at the best of times. Many now seeing that...
I'm not sure I think that's fair, Catherine. I think the Treasury, along with every other economic forecaster, is struggling at the moment to be able to say exactly what's going to happen. And actually, Treasury's overall record for forecasting compares pretty well.
Okay, so 4.2% growth they're predicting next year, but en route to that, given the constraints we have at the moment and the confidence loss at the moment, are we heading for a short, sharp recession en route to that?
That isn't the advice that we have. What we are, though, as we've just been discussing, is in the middle of a really difficult, challenging and volatile time for the global economy. And what we're trying to do in the budget yesterday is get the balance between supporting people through that period of time, but also getting into those structural issues that we've always needed to address in New Zealand to give that economic security. So that means the investments we make in skills and training and business and small business development and lifting our productivity and getting good public services. And it is a really challenging balance. Putting this budget together was one of the most challenging ones I've done because of the need to be able to do those two things. But I do believe we've got the balance right.
I understand that. I guess I'm looking for the longer term plan out of this pandemic and, you know, the idea of building back better. How are we going to do that? For a start on immigration, you had been wanting to limit immigration. You're now accepting, I think, certainly last week's policy announcements and what I'm hearing, that it's going to be essential to just maintain the skills and unskilled labour force we need for the next while. Are we going to return to the levels of tourism we had previously as a export earner? Is export education going to come back to the $4 billion it was earning as an export earner? Where is the build back better in this budget?
It's in a number of places. The first of those is in the announcements we made on Monday as part of our climate emergency response fund to enable us to build an economy that not only is a low emissions economy, but also takes the opportunities that come with shifting to things like renewable energy and regenerative agriculture. New Zealand is the best in the world at those things. And so there is economic opportunity there as well as dealing with the environmental challenges and $2.9 billion worth of investments there. Also in yesterday's budget is further support for our industry transformation plans. So that's about investing in the places that will give us those high wage jobs. That's agri-tech, that's advanced manufacturing, that's actually changing the nature of our tourism offering so it's more sustainable and generates higher paying jobs. It's also in the food and fibre area and food and beverage. And so all of that is there to get a more diversified economy. We've got a business growth fund we're establishing now with the retail banks to make sure that those small and medium enterprises who can't get access to the patient capital that they need because banks won't take the risk on them, that we can support them so those individuals don't have to take out second mortgages. It is a series of initiatives, Catherine, to diversify our economy and lift the value of what we do. That is the Build Back Better program.
The tech sector was pretty disappointed, actually, in its pre-budget announcement. And again, if we're going to get away from our two biggest export earners being dairy and tourism, that is a sector, surely, that needs a major injection. The adoption of its own development plan might not be a bad start, but it's not here.
There's a strong digital strategy that David Clark's been working through and working with the sector to deliver. And there was a $20 million investment in that, two parts to that. One, the development of the software as a service sector. The other, to be able to reach out into the world to better market and promote what we are doing in the digital economy. And we are continuing to invest there. It is about diversifying what we do. Our primary sector will continue to be a part of the New Zealand economy, but we want to add value and make that more efficient as well. So I actually think when you look across the board at the investments that we've made, we are shifting the dial on an economy that is more efficient from an environmental perspective and better at creating those high-wage jobs.
The quality of those investments, and particularly the quality of spending, has been a major focus of opposition parties. And look, let's even look at health, right? A huge spend, $11 billion over the forecast period. We're still hearing from almost every part of the sector, from pharmac-funded drugs, and I know that was a record spend, but still hearing from them, the medical specialties, nursing, huge pressures and service delays. What's coming out of that spending beyond paying off DHB debt, a big restructuring and some cost of living increases? What changes as a result of that big spend?
Well, the biggest change is the fact that we are moving away from the DHB model. And if we were putting $11 billion into the old model, I think the criticisms you've just gone through would have some validity. We're not. We're creating Health New Zealand and the Māori Health Authority to finally give us a nationwide health service that means you will get better quality of care wherever you live, and we will address these decades-long disparities that we've seen, particularly for Māori and Pacific Health. Will it take a little bit of time? Of course it will. In the meantime, we do have that record investment in PharmAct. We've got nearly $500 million going into primary and community care, more funding for mental health. So yes, we will be investing right now to improve those services. And I think everybody who works in the health sector, as frustrated as they might be about some of the things we've seen, have supported us in doing these reforms because they know we need to do them.
But the mental health spending is an interesting example because your own minister was frustrated, multiple occasions frustrated at getting answers over where that $1.9 billion had actually delivered actual outcomes. And I appreciate that's over multi-years, but this is the question people have. How does your government actually measure quality of spending? What is the mechanism used? How do you measure where things work, whether things work, and who's accountable for that?
Yeah, and Catherine, you're right. We've all been frustrated about the fact that the health system hasn't been able to deliver all of the care that we would want it to, given the extraordinary work of the professionals who work in the system. Hence why we're changing the system. When it comes to that mental health spending, we have done a thorough review of that, highlighted some areas where we could improve it, but also need to acknowledge that for the first time in primary care settings, I think we've got an extra 800 people working in there delivering services, 300,000 hours of extra services within that primary care mental health offering. What we put in this budget was money around the acute and specialists. And here's a good example for you, Catherine, of how difficult this is. Here in Wellington, when I've been working locally with some people trying to get support through that specialist care, one of the big issues isn't the funding, it's the availability of clinical psychologists. Now, we didn't have enough of those. We've trained more of them. It takes a few years to train them. And this is the issue we've had. We had too long where we underfunded our health system. We've now stepped in over the last couple of budgets, lifted that funding. Now we're making the structural changes to make sure that funding gets delivered more effectively and more efficiently. And so we are definitely on the right track here. But as everyone in the health system will tell you, it will take time given the underinvestment we've had in the past.
The rigour over matching spending and results is one that remains a question over your government. But I want to just finish, if you would, just talking about debt. Now, you've changed the debt measure. You might have good arguable grounds for changing it, makes it more consistent internationally, but it really can only fig leaf over a massive running up of Crown debt in the pandemic. The question is, who will pay that debt down and over what time frame? This is a subject of great debate between those who say you never have to pay it down and others who say actually you are mortgaging future generations in limiting what you can borrow to deal with future crises. Where do you sit on it? How much ought to be paid down and how quickly?
We've just had the IMF here in New Zealand, and they indicated to us that our debt sustainability was absolutely fine, that in fact there is fiscal headroom for us to deal with any other crises that come along. Our levels of debt, whether you measure them with the old measure or the new one, are far below most other countries in the OECD, significantly below Australia or the UK or Canada or the US. We do not have a debt problem in New Zealand. Do we need to keep managing it carefully? Absolutely. So using the new measure, we hit about 19% in 2024, and then it starts to trend down from there. That's around about, you know, 30-odd to 40-odd percent under the old measure. I am comfortable that New Zealand's position is strong, that our balance sheet justifies being able to use that debt to buffer ourselves against economic shocks and use it for long-term quality infrastructure. But I, you know, if you're asking me where I fall, New Zealand does not have a public debt problem.
It's not the problem. It's not the problem. You're a protege of Sir Michael Cullen, and is your position the same as his? That debt must be paid down when it can be to prepare for future costs. We're talking climate costs. Lordy knows what kind of adaptation climate costs, given recent reports that have just come out about the vulnerability of much of our infrastructure is in as soon as 10 to 20 years. You've got your liability costs coming up under your Paris climate commitments, $7.5 billion due at the end of 2030 unless cuts are made, and that's on current carbon prices. You've got great big transport ambitions that continually blow out cost-wise. So my question to you is, it's not about it being manageable, it's about whether you believe it needs to be paid down.
There's a balance here. It is in the forecasts coming down, and by the end of the forecast period, it ends up just under 15% net debt. But through this period of time, I do believe we can use our balance sheet to address some of those long-term infrastructure deficits. I talked about this in a speech about 10 days ago, where I do believe the time has come for us to not only keep the buffer, but also use some of it for those quality investments. And we'll be looking more at that as we head towards Budget 2023. But I am comfortable that New Zealand's debt levels are much lower than the countries we compare ourselves with, and they are sustainable.
We talked about this last year, and it was about whether there was the capacity in the public sector and or the willingness with the public sector to cooperate with private sector skills to deliver on many of your ambitions. And the transport projects that are years behind are just one example. Cost blowouts happening are just one example. Many of the ambitions you have for infrastructure require execution. And do you have, for all the extra people who've been hired into that public service, do you have the skill capacity and the attitudinal capacity to deliver on these programs? Because many have not been delivered on to date.
Well, without getting into a debate about that last comment, I would say that we always partner with the private sector when it comes to the delivery of infrastructure in New Zealand. I know some people want us to have a Ministry of Works back, but we don't, and therefore every single project we do involves that. If you're asking me to do another transmission gully, I'd say the way that the National Party structured that contract has actually cost New Zealanders, despite it being a fantastic road for people to drive on. So we'll keep working with the private sector. We do have, we have passed a law now, the Infrastructure Funding and Financing Act, that facilitates different kinds of partnerships between central government, local government and the private sector. And for example, in the Tauranga area, we are using that process to fund differently using a special purpose vehicle, a transport and urban infrastructure development. So we'll combine together, as we've just been discussing, the ability for the Crown to be able to borrow and finance these long-term projects with working with local government, private sector, iwi. We do that on a day-to-day basis, and we will keep doing it.
I guess it was more the lessons learned out of the pandemic and the frustrations, to use that word again, of the likes of Sir Brian Roche, who told you early on to embrace the skills in a very unique situation, the skills of the private sector to help look at logistics, help look at the vaccine procurement, not to run the show, not to take away the authority of government, but to tap into those skills. We had technology leaders frustrated to hell at, you know, trying to get a foot in the door with their solutions. And I guess that's what I'm talking about with these massive transformation projects that are your government's ambition, is the capacity and the attitude within the public sector up to it.
I think that is, Catherine, and I think throughout COVID we did work closely with the private sector and with anybody who was interested in helping and making sure that we delivered to New Zealanders, and I think we were successful in doing that through the COVID period. So yes, it is there. Equally, the government has to provide the leadership. The government has to do the prioritisation and the sequencing, and we are doing that. You know, in this budget, there's $60 billion there for infrastructure development. We will be delivering that in partnership with a whole host of different people.
Thank you very much for your time. Grant Robertson is the Finance Minister.